Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Of course, one of the most important battlefronts in that war at the moment is in Ukraine. And we're very pleased to be able to pick the brains of a former career intelligence officer for today's briefing about what's happening there and what its implications are, not just for the people most immediately involved or even for Europe, but for us as well. He is Sam Faddis, one of our valued regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is the former longtime undercover intelligence officer who's written a terrific book entitled Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the Central Intelligence Agency. He is also a former Army officer, as well as the driving force behind a terrific online resource you can now find at Substack called And Magazine. Sam, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
Well, where to begin? I guess sort of let's level set on what you believe has developed in the course of the past little over a week of land war instigated by Vladimir Putin, the dictator of Russia, against the government and people of neighboring Ukraine.
Well, I mean, just focusing on how the conflict has gone on the ground, I would say that my assessment is that Putin's plan was that he was going to go into Ukraine and very quickly decapitate the government and likely install some puppet who would then support his Putin's various claims that he was doing the right thing and fighting Nazis and so forth, and that this thing would kind of functionally be over and done with before the world really awakened and at relatively little cost. And I think that, well, that has not played out at all the way he intended. I think the Ukrainians have put up very stiff resistance. They obviously have gotten a lot of support from a number of other countries. And also, I think we've seen some real shortcomings, particularly logistical, in the Russian military. Just continuing reports of vehicles running out of gas and troops running out of food and the basic kind of stuff, right? They always say that amateurs talk tactics and professionals talk logistics, and the Russians have showed that their logistics don't work. So we're a week in. That plan didn't work. The whole thing, I mean, the Russians are now obviously resorting to a much broader, more indiscriminate use of violence. They may definitely still win this conflict, but it's clearly not what Vladimir Putin had in mind when he crossed the border.
Certainly not going to be cost-free, that's for sure. But the costs associated with all this to Ukraine are incalculable. I mean, you're seeing cities laid waste, and that's only the beginning, I'm afraid, particularly as it now becomes increasingly likely that will be inflicted upon the capital city of Kyiv. Do you see it that way, Sam? Is there going to be a sort of alternative to intense urban warfare, which might otherwise be required, with the use of perhaps thermobaric, highly destructive weapons to simply take out parts of, if not large swaths, of a place like Kyiv?
Well, if the Russians remain determined to try to prosecute this war successfully, then that's exactly where we're going, and we're already seeing that, right? The use of fuel, air, explosives, and so forth, which are definitely not precision weapons. I think that's exactly what they have to do if they intend to prosecute this. I keep phrasing it that way because obviously there's the calculus that Putin has to make. At what point does he elect to say that, okay, the cost is too high here and I look for an off-ramp and some way to claim that I have achieved some sort of objective and I walk away? I don't see I don't see that indication yet, but obviously that possibility exists.
Well, let's hope it's to be found. One of the things that I'm interested in exploring with you, Sam, is the role that the United States government has played in all of this. There's a report that Victoria Nuland, the Undersecretary of State, I believe, for policy, is said to have made a trip to Moscow back in October, in which she evidently communicated in a manner not unlike the notorious Ambassador April Glaspie, then the ambassador of the United States to Iraq, on the eve of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, that we didn't really have a dog in that fight. Nuland is said to have similarly indicated that the United States would sort of be indifferent should the Russians decide they had to use force to bend Ukraine to its will. Minor incursion, I think, is the way Joe Biden put it. And evidently, as you say, what Putin had in mind. Does that sound right to you based on what we know of the Biden administration, its conduct since October, for that matter, as well?
Well, it sounds completely plausible to me and completely consistent with what we've seen. I mean, as you just made a reference, I mean, Biden himself, shortly before this invasion started, was making comments suggesting that some sort of minor incursion wouldn't be a big deal kind of thing, which is in and of itself just kind of mind-bogglingly. Yeah, you can sort of chew on the Ukrainians a little bit and kill some of them, and we won't have a problem. But, you know, all of this, of course, is occurring against a backdrop that I think we cannot lose sight of. We are not just dealing with an administration that is incompetent and weak, and we're dealing with an administration that I think on an unprecedented scale in American history is compromised. We got a guy sitting in the Oval Office that has taken ungodly sums of money from the communist Chinese, but also from the Russians and every other thug he could find on the planet. And everything the man did from the moment he came into the Oval Office signaled weakness to Putin, right? Was the first thing he did would unilaterally disarm us in the sense of our oil and natural gas industry by attacking that, basically at that point, greenlighting the new pipeline that the Russians wanted it to Germany. And his whole track record is nothing but capitulation and weakness. And so I have no doubt that there are specific actions recently that mattered to Putin. But if you're Vladimir Putin and you're looking at Joe Biden, why on earth would you ever even remotely consider the possibility that this guy is actually going to stand up to you? I mean, and whatever Biden has done to date to stand up to Putin, I would submit, is just because he has been politically backed into a corner where he has no choice. It's all been reluctant. So I think Putin's calculation would be very reasonable. This guy's not going to do anything. And whatever sanctions he announces, sure, he'll put them in place for a limited period of time, but just as quickly he'll switch them all off when nobody's paying attention.
You know, one of the other items in that bill of particulars that you laid out well, Sam, is the fact that Biden also interposed objections to having Israel establish a pipeline for its gas exports with Cyprus to Europe, which would have, like, you know, opposing the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, that is, have interfered with Putin's desire to dominate the European energy markets. It's a sordid story, and I think you're right. The key point is, did it all translate into a completely unnecessary conflict? And to the extent it has, the culpability of this administration for what is befalling Ukraine is very real. And in addition to all of that, Sam, and you might just talk a little bit about the psychological impact this behavior had. When Biden was endlessly talking up how horrible it was going to be if the Russians invaded, and how, you know, in particular, they were going to, well, lay waste to Kyiv, and how, you know, he was going to try to extract Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, to get him out of there. All of this seems to have, you know, further played into the hands of being helpful to the Russians. undermining the will of the Ukrainians to resist, and for that matter, trying to deny them their elected leader in the midst of all of this. Walk us through how that may be bearing further on your thesis that this is a compromised guy who is batting for the other team.
Sure. Well, I mean, you're exactly right. What was he telling them? Oh, my God, this is the end of the world. If the Russians come, you're all doomed. There's nothing to do but, you know, get the president out, and this will be the end of the world. There's nothing in any of that commentary, or any of that discussion, or any messaging that actually suggested that the Russians would be the ones paying the price here, and that the Ukrainians absolutely could resist. We should also keep in mind, even if we're just talking specifically about Ukraine, I mean, Biden is a compromised guy, and that's been clear for a very long time. But on Ukraine, what is his track record? What is, when he was vice president of the United States, what did he do that suggested to the Ukrainians that he was actually going to stand up to the Russians? I mean, nothing.
Well, and that he was actually all good with the corrupt leadership of Ukraine at the time, and that, you know, which was, as I recall, aligned more or less with the Russians too. So, I mean, these are the sorts of things that just make your stomach churn at the thought of, being on the wrong side, as they say. Sam, one of the other pieces of this that I wanted just to hit with you quickly is how the Europeans have, at least in relative terms, manned up in all of this. Evidently, I think under considerable public pressure, to be sure, but still, it recalls to mind, of course, the famous line from Barack Obama that the United States was leading from behind. It sure looks that way in this episode, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we're seeing with the Biden administration is a complete fundamental change, in my opinion, in sort of the balance of power on the planet and the whole geopolitical order, if that's the right way to phrase it. Right. I think we get down in the weeds here and we look at specific things in isolation and kind of just think like, okay, well, that didn't go well and that was a debacle, but now we're back to some sort of normalcy, something that is within our realm of experience over the course of many decades. That's not where we are at all. I mean, this is a not just an incompetent administration. This is a completely compromised administration with a guy in the White House who is not acting in our interest. And unless we start actually just saying that out loud and focusing on that, we're just going to continue to careen from debacle to debacle, sort of kind of surprised. Well, Afghanistan didn't go great and Ukraine's a nightmare. And then what next? Taiwan.
And Afghanistan has to be put into this mix too, of course. Yeah. And that's really the key piece. We'll be talking more about this with Gordon Chang a little later in the program. But the reworking of the world order, the global reset, as some have called it, seems to be very much what is being accomplished here. And as far as one can tell, with the strong support of the Biden team, the rise of China, the decline of the United States, the Davos crowd, in the mix, capitalizing on it all. It's a sordid story and deeply alarming for those of us who actually recognize that the national security of the United States is going to be reset along the way in a very, very ominous fashion, Sam, and you certainly get that. Hey, let me switch gears quickly for the last little bit we have with you, Sam. There is a convoy of trucks headed east as we speak, reminiscent of the ones that we watched with such admiration in Canada until the Canadian government went full Marxist and essentially shut them down, stole their trucks, and otherwise began an oppression of the Canadian people unprecedented in the history of that country. What's in store for us with this convoy here? What do you think it means in terms of public sentiment about the sorts of things we've just been discussing?
Well, of course, a great deal of the media tries to pretend like this isn't happening at all. It is happening as of yesterday. out in Indiana, the convoy was 70 miles long and pushing 10,000 vehicles. And there are actually a host of other smaller convoys coming from all over the country that are feeding into it. I'm going to be going down and joining up with the convoy tomorrow and then going to the D.C. area on Saturday. Although, as I understand it, the intention of the convoy is not to go downtown. And of course, in our new forbidden city of D.C., Joe Biden is hiding from all of this by erecting walls and barriers and calling in the National Guard, because the prospect that the American people are going to come to their own capital city apparently terrifies him and those around him. The country's done. The country's furious. They're fed up with a government that has forgotten that it works for them and acts like some sort of imperial power. I think that's where we are.
Sam, did the president's remarks in the so-called State of the Union, I called it the gaslight of the Union, speak to this issue of the public revulsion with his policies by embracing a lot of things that aren't?
Well, I mean, there's a whole, you know, there's the whole part of the speech that people have been talking about where all of a sudden you hear Joe Biden endorsing ideas that sound like came straight out of the mouth of Donald Trump.
It did indeed.
He wants to secure the border now, apparently. That's
right.
Stunning.
Fund
but
the
it's
police.
All, of course, it's meaningless and it doesn't fool anybody. I mean, 30 seconds of him spouting some points doesn't change anything about what his policies are and what the reality is. The American people are not stupid. They see straight through that.
And they have rejected it, I think it's fair to say, as well as the polls are increasingly indicating. And I think this truck convoy exercise will as well. Sam, I'm delighted you're going to be there in person and wish you well and that of the convoy as it peacefully expresses the sentiments so many of us feel, namely that we're on the wrong track in this country and need a course correction urgently. As always, you're leading from the front and we appreciate you so much. Sam Faddis, your visits here are one of the high points of our week. We'll look forward to doing so with you again next week. In the meantime, stay safe and carry on. Next up, we'll speak with the former president of Albania about how this invasion of Ukraine looks from the so-called near abroad, as well as for the rest of Europe and us as well. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Back, and I'm very, very excited to say we are joined by Sali Berisha. He is a man of considerable distinction, having served as both president and prime minister, the first non-communist of each, in his country of Albania. He has been active as member of parliament in the years since leaving those posts, as a voice of freedom in his country. And we wanted to catch up with him as he has been speaking out lately about what the Russians are doing in Ukraine and what they are seemingly threatening to do to other nations, including his, in NATO and Europe more generally. Mr. President, it is an honor to have you with us, sir. Thank you very much for joining us. And we're very pleased to get your perspective on what has been taking place in the past week in Ukraine, not too far from where you all are, but more broadly, what is in the offing, as you see it now, for freedom in the European continent and beyond? Welcome.
It's a pleasure for me to be in the river, to be with you, Mr. Gaff. I thank you very much for this possibility. I think what's happening now, Vladimir Putin has deployed Russia as a superpower in Europe, based mostly on its nuclear weapons, because in other aspects, Russia is not at all a superpower, but it now a great, great threat to the peace and the security of Europe. Vladimir Putin.
Let me just ask, in the regard to that threat to Europe, I want to develop that a little bit more fully, but just from your perspective, how does what he's doing in Ukraine appear I guess increasingly
campaign of war crimes against the people of Ukraine and certainly against their leadership as well.
It's for sure a slaughter going on there, an unslaughter going on there, and is committing horrible crimes against humanity, genocide, and cultural genocide. Vladimir Putin is creating manu militari, want to create manu militari, the former Soviet Union empire, and next week to deploy the limited sovereignty doctrine of Leonid Brezhnev for other nations, de facto dominating Europe. And this is a very bleak day.
As I recall, that was basically what's mine is mine and what's yours is also mine, was sort of the Brezhnev doctrine, wasn't it? And you remember, of course, from firsthand hard experience in Albania, what it was like to live under the communist dictatorship, really, of your own government, but basically as a puppet state inside the Warsaw Pact, I guess. But when you look at the ambitions of Vladimir Putin, is there any question in your mind that other nations, perhaps including your own, are in fact in the crosshairs with him as well?
Mr. Gaffner, I think Balkan, long time, were one of the main ambitions of Kremlin. Kremlin, for centuries, wanted to have, via Serbia, an access to Adriatic Sea. And they never quit that idea. If you see his focusing on Bosnia, on Serbia, and on Kosovo, the next big threat in the European continent, I believe, is Balkan.
And by that you mean that there will be further aggression from Belgrade, from Serbia, against other nations in the Balkans?
At least it will be encouraged by Kremlin, these actions during the last year.
Well, this is certainly something that seems very much to be part of the playbook of not only the Kremlin, as you say, but also of some of its allies, notably, I think, the Chinese communists and perhaps the Iranians and who knows, the North Koreans as well, to spread this, criminal activity, I think, to put a fine point on it. Let me ask you specifically about a letter to which you strenuously objected that Vladimir Putin sent to the Europeans, warning them effectively that they were indeed at risk of retaliation by him for some of the things that they have been doing in response to this Ukraine invasion. Give us a quick sense of that letter and what you think the Europeans should make of it.
The letter was an arrogance, a demonstration of threat and arrogance from Putin. I think he caught somehow in surprise the European countries with his decision. Although it was a foretold. If we take other action toward Ukraine, Crimea, Luhansk, and all this. So the letter was a threat and an arrogance to the European leaders.
Mr. President, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk with you a bit about another threat to your country and Europe more generally, I believe, as well as to our own. That is the one emanating from George Soros.
Thank you very much. I will be happy with.
Welcome back. We are visiting with former President and Prime Minister Salih Berisha of Albania, a man who is continuing his public service to his country, and I believe to the free world, as a member of parliament in Albania. Mr. President, we were talking about Ukraine, what the Russians are doing there, what they are threatening to do to your country and others in Europe beyond Ukraine as well. I wanted to switch gears with you quickly to talk about another threat, one that you have been very much engaged in warning about and trying to counter inside Albania, and I believe in quite a number of other places as well. Talk, if you would, sir, about George Soros and what he has been doing in your country and its implication?
Thank you very much for this question. I could assure you that George Soros, with his foundation, worked hard to restore in Albania monistic system, the previous monistic system in one sense. That is, at the beginning, he helped so much the civil society, but at the end resulted that he built up a civil society network and put it entirely under the umbrella of former Communist Party. So, in the communist regime, we have had civil society, but was not at all an independent one, was totally dependent on the Communist Party. I regretted very much this action, because second, George Soros put so many media under control, supporting the previous Communist Party and government. And third, which is worse, Mr. Gaffney, which is worse, he undertook, sponsored, and organized a justice reform. At the end, it was the justice system in Albania was put entirely under government control, like being a branch of executive. Because of this, all these actions, I asked in 2017, declaring him non grata. I asked also publicly to US Congress to draft laws banning political activities of George Soros out of United States. I ask also to European Parliament banning laws to ban political activities of George Soros out of United States. So after my stand, and I stood, I have nothing personally against him. Never any personal problem with him. All was principal problems, but he used his links, his very strong links, and started, he wanted to declare me non grata during Trump administration for conspiracy against US policy. The conspiracy because I opposed his foreign policy in Balkans. George Soros has his own foreign policy. Then he failed. He failed with Trump administration. Once the administration changed, he changed the accusation and he succeeded to proclaim me, to designate me non grata on May 19, 2021.
Here in the United States, you're talking about. This is a stunning, real indictment, it seems to me, of his influence, both in your country, obviously, but also in others. Our country, he's been interfering with various aspects of our government for years, not least now in terms of these efforts to elect individuals to Secretary of State positions and various prosecutorial roles that has had a profound and very insidious effect, I think, on the rule of law in our country. So the fact that he's gone after you and trying to exclude you from the United States is says a lot about him. It doesn't speak so much about you. I'm very certain of that. One other country, of course, in your neighborhood that is very much wrestling with Soros and his machinations is the nation of Hungary. And I'm sure you're following what's happening there with the election that is now imminent and his interference with that election. Any words of advice to Viktor Orban and his country and his citizens, for that matter, about Soros, based on your own hard experience with him?
I think Viktor Orban fighting for countering George Soros' influence, not allowing Hungary to be turned in a Soros republic like Albania is turned now. But you stressed Hungary. I assure you that other country, his influence is enormous. His political influence is enormous. And sometimes, in my humble judgment, it comes even in the clear dissociation with US foreign policy. He supports initiatives which, for example, let's take Open Balkan. Open Balkan for the moment is a trilateral alliance, Serbia, Northern Macedonia, and Albania. Three other countries oppose it. As such, it represents a huge influence of Serbia and Russia in the region. But Albania and Macedonia are NATO countries, and they never should make steps to present themselves an area of influence of Serbia or Russia. But what happened, Mr. Gaffney? In every summit of this trilateral alliance, there is no U.S. diplomat present, but is always Alexis Soros present on them. Yes, present on them.
So this is a very direct influence operation.
Very, very direct.
And I guess what you're describing is the steady erosion of freedom in your own country as it has become more aligned with, well, I suppose the communists of old, as well as Soros and his influence operations.
It's an extraordinary support for the government. Soros' influence on some U.S. diplomats, in my humble judgment, is higher than the State Department influence on them. Yes. Could you imagine the night of the election, U.S. ambassador go and meet the head of Central Election Commission and congratulate it for the elections, and the next day she do the same. The State Department official do the same without quoting or stressing, at least, that complaints must be reviewed. Just greeting Edi Rama for his victory and expressing their pleasure to work with him. Rama is a very close friend of George Soros, is the man on whom Soros had invested more in the region.
So this is really part of the pattern of his behavior, which is trying to essentially, accomplish a great reset, I guess one might say, in these various countries that have freed themselves over the years from totalitarianism and communism and are now being inexorably drawn back into more and more repressive, alignments. And we appreciate so much, President Saleh Berisha, your efforts to raise the alarm, both in your own country, obviously, but also abroad, including here on our program, about these developments, notably those now taking place in Ukraine, of course, but also what's happening less visibly, but no less dramatically at the hands of George Soros. I hope you'll come back to us with updates on all of this, Mr. President, and in the meantime, that you'll keep up the good work. We appreciate it very much. Thank you for your time today. Very telling, and we appreciate you pointing that out, sir. Thank you very much for your time. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. We'll take stock on China and why Joe Biden didn't mention it in his State of the Union address.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. We'll
We're back, and it's time for one of the high points of our week, and I'm sure yours, and that is our weekly visit with the great Gordon Chang. He is well known to listeners to this program, and I think most of the sentient world, because he is one of our country's preeminent experts on Asia, and specifically on the Chinese Communist Party. He's the author of a number of books, including The Coming Collapse of China. He writes for such outstanding outlets as the Gatestone Institute and Newsweek. He is also a formidable force on Twitter, which I encourage all of you to follow him there, at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, I followed you to CPAC last week. It was good to see a little bit of you and hear you holding forth in various settings. Thanks for the work you do there and, well, the work you do here, too. We're always glad to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. And it was great seeing you at CPAC.
A lot to talk about in your part of the battle space. Specifically, Gordon, I'm interested in what is gaining, I think, considerable currency, if I can use that expression, namely that in the wake of the against the Kremlin for its invasion of Ukraine, involving unplugging Russia from the so-called SWIFT system, that we've set in motion a process that the Chinese have aspired to for quite some time, which is kind of the de-dollarization of the world economy. You've been very skeptical of there being a real challenge to the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. Is that still your view, Gordon?
It certainly is, Frank. Clearly, the Chinese want the Russians to become part of a renminbi world rather than a dollar world. And we've seen this in a number of ways. So, for instance, about a week ago, there was an announcement that two large Chinese state banks would no longer provide dollar financing for Russian commodity purchases. And people were saying, oh, you know, this is China trying to distance itself from Russia. Well, maybe, Frank, but also we've got to remember that there was no similar restrictions on renminbi financing of commodity purchases. And of course, these were only two of China's many state banks. This, to me, at the time, struck me as an attempt to attack the dollar rather than an attempt to constrain Russia. Also, there have been these reports that China is trying to get Russia into SIP, the cross-border interbank payment system, which is China's version of SWIFT. Now, of course, Frank, with the United States using the dollar as a weapon against Russia, that politicizes the dollar. That doesn't help our status as the world's reserve currency. But remember, it's a cause that we the world shares. So I don't think we'll receive too much blowback from that. And also because we have to do something about the Russian invasion. And clearly the Biden administration's attempts to deal with Russia have been inadequate. So we do have to use the dollar. Now, the Chinese have been trying to attack the dollar since the mid-1990s, but today the usage of the renminbi is still in the low single digits. And that is because of a number of factors that basically China can't change. So China's attack on the dollar, they may want to do it, but not anytime soon.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, because it's going to be a dark day if they can pull that off. The chairman of the Federal Reserve seemed to be signaling, I think yesterday, that this may actually be in the offing. He said something to the effect, Jay Powell did, that can be more than one reserve currency. I'm not sure that's been the case heretofore, Gordon. Has it? And whether it has or hasn't, what do you make of Jay Powell making such a statement?
A couple things. First of all, many countries use euros and put them in their reserves. Now, the euro, of course, is also challenged because of structural problems. So the dollar is going to remain there. There's only one nation that can undermine the dollar. And of course, that's the United States. And we can do that through issuing too much debt, too much spending. I don't think Jay Powell's comments are really, first of all, appropriate. But second of all, I don't think they describe the world as it is. You know, you can talk about the euro, but that's about it. So it's
well,
not
a basket of currencies and special drawing rights and so on, or cryptocurrencies, some are suggesting, are going to be filling this gap. But again, I take your point that it isn't quite clear how you get there from where we are at the moment. But the very concerted interest of a number of nations, including the one you follow particularly closely, of course, Communist China, in achieving this is not to be ignored, it seems to me. Let me just ask
Frank,
you about...
If I could mention, you know, cryptocurrency is a separate issue, and that is many, many factors going into that. And if there were ever to be a change in the currency that countries use, yes, it would be crypto. But let's remember, it's not going to be China, because China's currency is not convertible on the capital account. It's barely convertible on the current account. Nobody expects China to manage its currency for the benefit of the world. And also, in order to have a reserve currency, you have got to put your currency out in the world, which means you've got to run persistent current account deficits. China is not doing that. So there's structural reasons, in addition to just others, about why China's renminbi is not going to challenge the dollar, at least as long as the Communist Party rules China. You know, we can talk about the euro, we can talk about cryptocurrencies, but, you know, people have mentioned the renminbi for ages, and for ages, the use of the renminbi has either stalled or gone down.
We will be watching this space closely. I'm mindful, Gordon, that others are also concerned about it. Zero Hedge has a piece today saying that the Chinese won't invade Taiwan until they've sort of sorted this out. Again, if you're right, then I guess that means Taiwan will be spared what otherwise seems to be a much more imminent design. In fact, talk if you would, Gordon, about the Chinese foreign minister putting down a marker. I think it was roughly coincident with the president's so-called State of the Union address that, you know, the United States couldn't do anything about what China does with respect to Taiwan. Do I have that right? And what did you make of this latest act of expression of defiance?
Well, first of all, the Chinese might invade Taiwan because we have seen a complete failure of American deterrence of Russia with regard to Ukraine. This is an issue of political will. But let's remember also that there are many reasons why China will not invade Taiwan. These are factors that inhibit it, which the foreign minister didn't talk about. So first of all, in order to invade Taiwan, Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, has to give some general or admiral almost complete control over the Chinese military, making that figure the most important and powerful person in China. Xi Jinping is not about to do that, and there's a lot of Communist Party history, in addition to other factors. And second of all, China is extremely casualty adverse these days. And let me just go through one anecdote to show you how fragile the Chinese political system is. On the night of June 15th, 2020, China launched a surprise attack against Indian troopers in Ladakh in the Himalayas. And India immediately reported that 20 Indian soldiers were killed that night. It was not until February of the following year, last year, that China admitted that 4 Chinese soldiers were killed. India believes that 45 Chinese soldiers were killed, and TASS issued a report about 2-3 months ago, which agreed with the Indian assessment that 45 Chinese soldiers had died the night of June 15th, 2020. That shows you how casualty adverse the Chinese are. Now, Chinese propaganda always says that they're one of the strengths of China is that they're not worried about Chinese soldiers being killed and injured, but that's not the case. If China does invade Taiwan, it will be because of a failure of American political will. We can defend Taiwan. We can defend Taiwan a number of ways, including the occupant of the Oval Office getting in front of TV cameras and saying, we're going to defend Taiwan. We will offer a mutual defense treaty to Taipei if they want it. Those two acts could very well stop the Chinese by themselves, because China right now knows that a war on Taiwan would be unpopular with most Chinese people. And I'm sure the Chinese are now starting to see how resistant and heroic the Ukrainian people are. And they know that Taiwan people would be the same way. So this is not a situation which is really going to be, as Chinese propaganda says. As I said, the issue here is not China's military might or Taiwan's military weakness. it's really a failure of American political will, the one that we saw in Afghanistan, the one that we're seeing with regard to Ukraine.
Gordon, one of the things that I have heard bruited about the resistance on Taiwan is talk about a fairly large contingent inside of Taiwan of, sympathizers with the mainland, shall we say, if not actually agents of or, you know, operatives for the Chinese Communist Party. To what extent do you think that's the case, and how does that factor in to calculations about how the resistance might go to an invasion of Taiwan by the Chinese Communist Party?
The concern about Chinese sympathizers in Taiwan is one which I believe is diminishing. But the concern about Chinese operatives in Taiwan is one that is growing. And Taiwan, under President Tsai Ing-wen, the Democratic Progressive Party of Taiwan, a Taiwanese-based political organization, is dealing with this and probably dealing with it quite effectively. The problem for China, and this is a long-term problem, is that people on Taiwan don't increasingly identify themselves as Taiwanese. When we look at self-identification surveys, it used to be about two-thirds of the people viewed themselves as Taiwanese. Now that number is north of 80. And correspondingly, people who viewed themselves as Chinese only were generally a little bit north of 10%. Now, again, they're basically in the low single digits. So Taiwan as a society is moving away from China, which means that sympathizers, that's becoming less of a factor, but China is doubling down on its subversion of Taiwan with its operatives. So two different issues here.
Fascinating. We'll be watching that one closely, Gordon, for further developments. I think you mentioned in connection with Ukraine, Gordon, the bankruptcy of our elites contributing to this invasion. That seems to be operating extensively with respect to China, of course, as well. Talk a little bit about the elite capture phenomenon and the extent to which the Chinese may be calculating that, well, starting with Joe Biden and his corruption, as we discussed with Sam Faddis earlier in the program, is a big consideration for them in terms of deciding whether they can mount such an attack or not.
Well, China has penetrated all institutions in the United States. They use every point of contact to undermine us. And they are overwhelming us. As FBI Director Christopher Wray said, they open up a new China counter-espionage case every 10 hours. They got, I believe, over 2,000. No other country, he says, mounts such a challenge to the United States. But it's not just espionage. It's just also influence operations, as we see in Wall Street, Walmart, corporate boards, academic institutions, you know, high schools. China's worked very hard to do this. The good news here is that the American people are increasingly aware of this and are moving against it. Just to give you an example, Virginia, the gubernatorial election, this was an issue about teaching in the Virginia schools. China has been openly promoting critical race theory, but parents in Virginia took their state back. And I think you can see similar movements elsewhere. The other thing is that there is an increasingly there's an increasing view in the United States that China helped Russia and is helping Russia in the invasion of Ukraine. This is going to delegitimize China, especially as the stories out of Ukraine become even more horrific. So things can move in the right direction, especially if Americans start to realize this and start pushing back in a more organized, determined, and vigorous way. And I think that that is happening, Frank, but make no mistake, we've got a very long road to go to removing Chinese influence in our country, because the communists have done an excellent job over decades, and we have failed to counter that. And that's Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives.
No, you're so right. And as you've pointed out on this program and elsewhere, Gordon, in part that's a function of our allowing such behavior without reciprocity on their part. It's just mind-boggling, and I'm so appreciative of your leadership in calling them out, and for that matter, our elites out as well. Lastly, Gordon, on this, let me just say it's been remarked by a growing number of people that in Joe Biden's so-called State of the Union address, I call it really the gaslight of the Union address, the president never mentioned, not once, communist China. And I've compared this to a doctor, you know, consulting with you about your COVID malady without mentioning that you have stage 5 cancer. What do you make of the fact that he didn't bring it up at all in a discussion of the state of our union? Does it have, in fact, no bearing on it?
Of course it has bearing, Frank. Let me just give you one example, which I thought was particularly egregious, and that is Biden talked about fentanyl, and he talked about what we must do to end the fentanyl epidemic, and he didn't mention China. I mean, as we've talked about before, the Communist Party is working with these large, far-flung fentanyl gangs. And China's Communist Party is working with the Chinese money launderers that take the money that these gangs earn and launder it through the Chinese banking system with their burner phones and Chinese banking apps. Because the Communist Party runs a near total surveillance state, they know what's going on. And Biden needed to talk about this. Now, he did make, I think, one glancing reference to China, but it was insubstantial. And of course, if you talk about the state of the American Union, you have to mention China because they're attacking us. They've killed 950,000 Americans with coronavirus. That's the latest death toll from Johns Hopkins. Even if one says the death toll is lower, it's still in the hundreds of thousands, Frank. And to me, it's inexplicable, and it means that Biden shouldn't be president if he doesn't want to defend us from a country that's attacking us.
Amen. And attacking us relentlessly, as you've really done an outsized job documenting, Gordon, for decades via this unrestricted warfare technique. So much more to cover with you, Gordon, but we are hard out of time for today. Thank you for your time, as always, and your great expertise and your clarity on all of these issues. We treasure them. I look forward to catching up with you again next week on the topics we've discussed in the way of updates, but also on new developments that I'm sure we will have to confront. Thank you, my friend. God bless you. We'll talk soon. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us, and I hope you'll do so again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.